This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a discussion by author James Dubik on his book entitled Just War Reconsidered, Strategy, Ethics, and Theory. I'm your host, Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago, and is sponsored by members of the museum and library. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. In the seminal Just and Unjust Wars, Michael Walzer famously considered the ethics of modern warfare, examining the moral issues that arise before, during, and after conflict. In Just War Reconsidered, James Dubik draws on years of research as well as his own experiences as a soldier and teacher to fill the gaps left by other theorists. Dubik applies moral philosophy, political philosophy, and strategic studies to historical and contemporary case studies to reveal the inaccuracies and moral bankruptcy that inform some of the literature on military ethics. Conventional just war theory adopts a binary approach wherein political leaders have moral accountability for the decision to go to war and soldiers have accountability for fighting the war ethically. Dubik argues, however, that political and military leadership should be held accountable for the planning and execution of war in addition to the decision to initiate conflict. Dubik offers new standards to evaluate the ethics of warfare in the hope of increasing the probability that the lives of soldiers will not be used in vain and the innocent not put at risk unnecessarily. Lieutenant General James N. Dubik, United States Army retired, is a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. He earned a PhD in philosophy from the Johns Hopkins University and a Master of Arts and Science from the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He was a professor at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic Studies before being promoted to his current title of Director of Teaching. He held the Omar Bradley Chair of Strategic Leadership from 2012 to 2013, a position co-sponsored by Dickinson College, Penn State Law School, and the U.S. Army War College. Please join me in welcoming Lieutenant General Dubik to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you, too, for being here tonight, and for your applause even before you hear what I have to say. So I hope when I'm done, there'll be at least the same amount of applause. So this book, Just War Reconsidered, is the result of my dissertation in philosophy from Johns Hopkins. I wrote it in the period 2012 to 2014. So I was 63 when I started and 65 when I defended my dissertation. My fellow students, of course, were younger than my youngest children. And my advisor, great advisor Hilary Bock, Professor Hilary Bock, was just a few years older than my oldest daughter. So it was kind of odd. And actually, I didn't start out this way. I really thought that when I went back to school in philosophy in 1980, the Army sent me back 2 years to study so I could teach at West Point, that I would try in those 2 years to finish all my course requirements, the language exams, the comprehensive exams, and write my topic, and then use the 3 years that I was teaching at West Point to write my dissertation. That was my plan. It was a good plan. Of course, it failed, like so many other plans. I found that while I got all the exams and stuff out of the way before I got to West Point, teaching was a lot harder than I anticipated, and I didn't have time to write. And for sure didn't on my next assignment, because I was the executive officer of the 1st Ranger Battalion. And writing a dissertation of philosophy and jumping out airplanes were almost mutually incompatible activities. So I delayed all this until I retired in 2008. And then my wife, being a good wife, says to me, "Jim, aren't you a J in Myers-Briggs?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "Aren't you like a real big J, like capital J, bold, 28 or 30 font?" And I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am." And she said, "Well, then why do you have this task, get a PhD, unchecked on your giant task list of life?" Well, you know, what am I going to do now? And, you know, the gauntlet's down. And so I began a discussion with Johns Hopkins. I was living in Alexandria, where I still lived, Virginia. Drove over to Baltimore, started this conversation, and the first thing out of the chairman's mouth was, "So, do you have any proof that you were here?" Of course, this, when I was there, it was all pre-digital age, so there was no proof. Luckily, my wife, besides being a good jabber, is a good organizer. So I brought with me my copy of every letter that said, "Congratulations, you passed this exam or that exam," a copy of my transcript, and the letter that I had received from the chairman at the time saying that as long as I was on active duty, Johns Hopkins would waive the requirements to pay in absentia and waive the time requirements in which to finish. Now, this was an important letter that she saved, because without that, I don't think they would have let me back in, but they did. And in the end, I'm kind of glad I did it that way, because that gave me really 37 years of field research. And what I wrote in 2012 and 14 would have been way different from what I've written as a senior captain, young major in 1982. So I'm grateful for the break, even though I hadn't planned it that way. I had the opportunity as a colonel to lead American forces in the invasion of Haiti in 1994. I was responsible for the northern half of the country. So I had the opportunity to reinstate the Aristide government there, to reinstate the police forces, to reinstate their judicial process and get things going. I had a great experience that I would not have had. As a one-star, I was the assistant division commander in the 1st Cavalry Division. Went to Bosnia and was the deputy commanding general of Multinational Division North, about a third of the country, where we enforced the Dayton Accords. I wouldn't have had that experience. And then as a three-star, just before I retired, I was the commanding general of Multinational Security and Transition Command in Iraq during the surge. And my responsibility was to grow the Iraqi security forces, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines on one hand, and police forces on the other, and in size, capability, and confidence, and then help the ministries of defense and interior. So I wouldn't have had those experiences, which, again, in retrospect, these and many others made what I wrote, I think, much more practical than it would have been if I had done it otherwise. As mentioned earlier, I have used Michael Walzer's Just and Unjust Wars in my teaching. I used it at West Point. I also used it in the School of Advanced Military Studies at Leavenworth, where I was a teacher for a year. I used it at Army War College. Teach just war theory there at Dickinson College, at Penn State Law School, and at Georgetown. So I think that the perspective that this interlude gave me has been a perspective and maturity that, again, I just wouldn't have. And it brought me to a point where I'm pretty confident in saying that there's a gap in traditional just war theory. Just war theory has three parts: jus ad bellum, justice in going to war; jus in bello, justice in the conduct of war; and jus post bellum, justice in the end of wars. And I wanted to focus in the middle, the jus in bello, because my belief is that the traditional theory is too narrow. It focuses only on what happens on the battlefield. That's necessary, absolutely necessary, but it's insufficient because it leaves out what happens in the capitals, what happens at the strategic level in the conduct of war. And when I saw that gap, I realized that this was a good place for me to write about and maybe make a contribution, not just to the theory of just war, but to the practice in both the civilian and military dimensions. Michael Walzer's book, Just and Unjust Wars, is in its fifth edition. This is a tremendous accomplishment for anything written about philosophy or by a philosopher. It was first written in 1977, right at the end of the Vietnam War. And even those who criticize it use it as the base case. It's well argued, it's well reasoned, and covers the gamut pretty well. It's not to say everyone agrees with it, they don't, but it is the traditional just war theory, so that's what I use. Now, let me say right off the bat, my book and my remarks are aimed at the United States. Walzer wants to make a case for a more universal just war theory. I'm not that ambitious. I want to talk about the United States, and if you can generalize it beyond that, fine. If not, that's fine, too. I don't want to generalize it. I want to talk to us as citizens of the United States and how we conduct wars and how we should conduct wars. So let me get right to it now about the book. I'm not telling many of you anything new when I say war uses lives. It can't be any other way. Sometimes it ends lives, sometimes it damages lives, sometimes it changes lives forever. And these are lives not just of the soldiers who fight it, but also of families, of the innocent that always get caught up with, and of the political communities on whose behalf war is fought. And when I say soldiers, I'm going to use that as shorthand. I'm an Army guy, so it's okay for me. But really, I should be saying soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians who are on the battlefield, but that's too much of a mouthful. And in about a half hour, I'd be stumbling over my own tongue. So I'm just going to say soldiers. And the United States has been waging war now for 18 years since 9/11. And to put it kindly, we're not anywhere near where any senior leader in 2001 would have predicted. And note that I said waging war. And I meant to say that on purpose, because I think there's a big difference between waging a war and fighting a war. And this difference has not just strategic implications, but has moral implications as well. At the tactical war fighting levels, America had done pretty well. I think there's general consensus that our soldiers have done everything that we had asked them to do and more. No one doubts the courage and the sacrifice of those who have been fighting on our behalf for almost two decades. No one doubts the sacrifices that they have made and their families have made. And overall, most people agree that our soldiers have fought well. At the strategic war waging level, however, there is no such agreement. If there's any agreement, it's that we have not cloaked ourselves in excellence at all. After all, after almost two decades of war, there really hasn't been much to show for it. Yes, okay, we have killed bin Laden and now his son and lots of other people in the process. Yes, we have prevented another 9/11 attack, which is no small achievement and which we should take some pride in. But overall, we are far from achieving any of the strategic aims set at the beginning or adjusted ever since. So the question becomes, has the lives of our citizens who became soldiers to fight on our behalf, have they been used well or have they been used poorly? And to answer this question, you should be able to go to just war theory. Ask that question and ask the question, have the lives of the innocent who always get caught up in war, have they been risked necessarily or have they been risked unnecessarily? These are legitimate questions about waging war. And naturally, you should turn to just war theory and ask yourself. Unfortunately, the answers you're going to get are not very well developed, because jus in bello, justice in the conduct of war, in the traditional sense, has been focused narrowly on combat, on what happens on the battlefield. Now, this is, again, very important, and it's a huge contribution. But jus in bello, the conduct of war, is limited to about five areas. Number one, is the action a legitimate action of war? Number two, have you attended to the distinction between combatants and non-combatants and kept the war as much as you can between combatants and excluding non-combatants? Number three, have the force you used proportional to the effect you want to have? Number four, have you limited the damage that you caused and the death you caused to civilians by employing the principle of double effect? That is, you're aiming narrowly at a legitimate target using proportional force, and you're, the civilians who happen to die in the process are not part of your direct intent. And number five, are you giving due care to civilians by assuming due risk of yourself as a soldier? These are five. These are the five areas that govern the conduct of war in traditional just war theory. And these are important. They're based on a theory of rights, that all human beings have rights to life and liberty, and that combatants lose or have their rights significantly abridged when they enter the category of dangerous people by their training, by entering into an army or the armed services of another country, and become combatants. Whereas non-combatants don't ever lose their rights. And this traditional approach, use of rights in those five areas, is generally accurate. Application gets fuzzy, but everyone kind of expects that. And in fact, these five elements are very well accounted for in the laws of land warfare, very well accounted for in the rules of engagement, and very well accounted used by soldiers and to govern their behavior on the battlefield. Yes, there's been in some violations of these rules. There's no doubt about it. They're well publicized, but they've been the exceptions, not the rule. And they emphasize how much these five areas do govern by the action that the United States has taken in response to their violations. The problem with the traditional approach, though, is two. First, the conduct of war involves more than fighting. Wars have to be fought, but they also have to be waged, and waging is a significantly distinct activity. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. The second problem is that the traditional approach assumes there's a hard line between the area of who's responsible for going to war and who's responsible for the conduct of war. In traditional just war theory, political leaders are responsible to go to war, military leaders are responsible for the conduct of war. No such hard line really exists, and I'll talk more about that. So let's take each of these two problems in turn. First, waging war and fighting wars. Let me use two examples to kind of get at this. The first comes from Colonel Harry Summers' book called Strategy, the Vietnam War in Context. And he, in the book, very beginning, he recounts this exchange in 1975 in Hanoi. And I'm going to quote now. An American colonel said to the North Vietnamese counterpart, "You know, you never defeated us on the battlefield." The North Vietnamese colonel replied, "That may be so, but it's also irrelevant." Second example comes from a recent book, The New Rules of War by Sean McFate. Now, this is not Sean speaking. I'm going to quote, actually, General Stan McChrystal, who wrote the introduction to the book. "As in many wars against such foes, my troops won most firefights. We were better armed. We were better trained. We were better managed. However, our tactical successes gave both soldiers and policymakers the false impression that our strategy was working. In reality, we were simply carrying out discrete missions that were often brutally effective against our foe, but which were not truly rooted in any unifying national strategy or ultimate endgame." So the point here is that wars have to be waged as well as fought. And waging war involves three morally relevant activities. The first is what I'm going to call achieving coherency. And this is identifying war aims that are achievable and then aligning to those war aims military and non-military strategies, policies, and campaigns that increase the probability that your aims will be achieved. So that's the coherence, achieving coherence. Second has to do with organizational capacity. Senior leaders, military and civilian, at the strategic level, act through organizations. So the second requirement is to create sufficient organizational capacity to translate decisions into action. And then as the actions unfold in ways that you can never anticipate, you can see the gap between what you wanted to achieve and what was actually happening, adapt by closing that gap, and bring the use of force or war to a successful end by achieving your strategic aims. So that's the second organizational capacity. And the third is sustaining legitimacy in terms of public support for the war. And this has to do with going to war for the right reasons, fighting the war, following the laws of war, demonstrating that the war is winnable by having a strategy and making progress toward that strategy, and ensuring the proper integration of civil and military leadership. So achieving coherence, creating organizational capacity, and sustaining legitimacy. Traditional just war theory says little or nothing about any of these three responsibilities, even though these activities have a huge impact on how the war is conducted. Because when you can't achieve or don't achieve coherency, when you have no organizational capacity or insufficient, and when you erode your own legitimacy, the lives of the innocent are put at increased risk, and the lives of soldiers are either used poorly or wasted altogether. And the life of the political community comes to increased risk. So poor execution can also drag on a war unnecessarily. So if you're going to have a complete account of the conduct of war, jus in bello, my belief is then you have to combine the tactical and the strategic, the war fighting and the war waging, into a complete account of jus in bello. So that's the first problem, that war involves more than fighting. Second problem, the hard line between those responsible for the war itself and those responsible for its conduct. Well, in the real world, no such line exists. It's very nice and neat in the conceptual or theoretical world, but this hard line just doesn't exist in reality. Simply put, senior political and military leaders in the U.S., and senior, these guys are the president, the secretary of defense, the chairman, the combatant commanders, the geographic combatant commanders, maybe some other small set of political leaders and civilian leaders, this set shares the responsibility of waging war. And it's been like that from the start of the Republic. I mean, think of President Lincoln. He was very much involved in the conduct of the Civil War. He just didn't decide, well, we're going to go to war and turn it over to the generals. Well, actually, he did that, but then it worked out so badly, he brought it back to his purview. And his discussions with his generals were extensive. In 1863, late 63, early 64, he and Grant had a good number of meetings and discussions about the 64-65 campaign that ultimately went down now I-95 and across into Appomattox. President Lincoln was very much involved in the war's conduct. He had to be. There were huge political stakes. Not just personal, because there was a re-election in 1864, but also huge political stakes, whether the Union would stay together. FDR in World War II, also hugely involved in the campaigns, the military campaigns of World War II, in developing a strategy with Churchill, with Stalin occasionally. And a really good example is the North Africa campaign. I mean, he personally made that decision against the advice of his military advisors, who wanted to go straight to England in 1942 into France. Luckily, he vetoed that operation. But presidents have always, and rightfully so, been involved in war-waging decisions in the conduct of war. Truman in Korea, Johnson and Nixon in Vietnam, Bush 41 in the Gulf War, in very much detail in discussion with Secretary Cheney and Chairman Powell and General Schwarzkopf, and how the war was going to be conducted and how the campaign was designed and going to be carried out. All the presidents have been involved. The issue is, have they been involved well or poorly? And that's the question. Not are they going to be involved, because they have to be. War is a political act. You can't take the politics out of war, or you have wanton violence. So presidents are involved. Secretaries of Defense are involved, as are generals, in creating coherence, in generating organizational capacity, and sustaining legitimacy. Political leaders cannot alone wage wars, and neither can military leaders. They need each other. And it's a phenomenon, war, that requires each other. The political approach of saying, hey, let us figure out the policy, we'll tell you guys in uniform what we want you to do when we figure it out. Or the military angle of, hey, I don't want to talk about this policy stuff, just tell me what you want me to do and then stay out of my way while I do it. These are equally foolish approaches to waging war. War is inherently both military and civilian. Now, for sure, in our system and in other democracies, the civilian leaders, the president in our case, has final decision authority. And that's as it should be, and that is not something that is in question. But in leading up to the decision, the voices of the military and political leaders are very much necessary. The argument, the dialogue is necessary so that the final decision authority is used well, is well informed. And the process leading up to a decision, the integrity of that process is upheld by those in the process, the political and military leaders. And the fidelity of the information, again, is up to the people in that process. There are no separate process police or information integrity police that sit on the end and tap with a whip. Oh, that's not true. Process foul. The integrity of the process and the fidelity of the information is the responsibility of those in the process. And the same thing is true following a decision. War waging decisions are executed not just by the Department of Defense and the military commanders. You look at our own post 9/11 wars. The other departments have huge important roles to play in the execution of the decisions. The same was true of World War II, same was true of World War I, same was true in the Civil War. War waging decisions are civil, executed by civil and military leaders. The last part in the decision-making process is after a decision is made and after you execute it, you're going to find out that some of the stuff you decided on works and some doesn't. And you're going to have to adapt the initial decisions to hold on to what works and change what doesn't work. And so civilian and military leaders involved in the process have to speak up and help the final decision authority make the best decision possible. It's having the final decision authority, one thing. Using it well is another. And to use it well requires both civil and political and military leaders. So yeah, if you want to talk about Elliot Cohen, yes, the dialogue between the civil and military is unequal in the sense that the president has final decision authority, okay. But it's equal in the functional, procedural, and moral senses. So there's much more equality when you really look at it than inequality. Again, the traditional account of just war theory says little or nothing about this shared responsibility, about the line that really doesn't exist in the conduct of war, how mutual the conduct of war is. Because the purpose of the civil-military relationship is not to show who's in charge of whom, who's in control of whom, as too often people are talking about. The Constitution and U.S. Code make that very clear. The civilian leaders and the president are in charge, period, end of discussion. It's not the question about who's in control. The purpose of the civil-military relationship is to increase the probability that you have war aims that are achievable, to increase the probability that your military and non-military strategies, policies, and campaigns will actually achieve your aims, to increase the probability that your bureaucracies will work to execute the decision you're made, and to increase the probability that you will create and sustain legitimacy in the conduct of your war. Why? So that soldiers' lives are used well, so that the innocents are risks only necessarily as the political community can be secured. And these responsibilities of senior political and military leaders are just as important as soldiers and leaders on the battlefield. The only difference is distance. Look, is really, if you're a soldier or a leader on a battlefield, it's very clear you're responsible. The immediacy of the destruction and death that, at your hands makes it clear. But less clear because of the distance is the responsibility of senior political and military leaders in the conduct of war. That doesn't change the fact that it exists. And a public language of the last 18 years confirms its existence because we hear over and over again the questions and the expectations of the American public that we expect senior leaders to be able to account for their decisions and account for their actions, to explain what they have done, to justify what they had done. And sometimes this is in a political campaign, sometimes this is in front of Congress, sometimes this is in front of media, sometimes this is in front of the very soldiers with whom you have fought or who you have ordered into battle. But explanation, justification, this goes along with the territory of leadership. So for me, the conclusion is clear. The issue is that traditional just war theory is necessary but insufficient. There's a gap in it. It's focused too narrowly on combat and not enough at the strategic level. And the moral dimension of the conduct of war, jus in bello, includes both what happens on the battlefield and what happens in the capital. So if you want to have a practical morality, which is Walzer's view and every other practicing just war theorist, if you want to have a practical theory that can guide people's actual actions in war, then you have to combine the two. But to do so requires a set of principles that can guide action and decisions at the strategic level, just like the five things I mentioned before at the tactical level. And so in my book, I present five. And I do say at the end that I'm pretty confident in the five, but I'm willing to argue about every one of them. I think that in the end, I'll give myself a go. I've identified the right gap. I give myself a go, identify what has to fill that gap. But I give myself a tentative go whether these five are exactly the right ones. But I think they're good enough to put out there and let me take the whoopings as they begin. So the first is the principle of continuous dialogue. This principle recognizes that there's a necessity for a robust, a continuous dialogue, contentious dialogue, before a war begins, during a war, throughout the war, and as the war is coming to an end. That this dialogue concerns aims, it concerns strategy, policies, and campaigns, military and non-military, and it concerns execution and adaptation in war and bringing the war to an end. Because the war itself is a continuous activity, it needs a continuous dialogue. And it's not an episodic dialogue. It needs a decision and action regime, much like corporations have, where you're in continuous dialogue so that as you have to adapt to things you can't foresee, which is about most things in war, you can make the decisions that you can. It can't be episodic. It can't be, okay, we're gonna meet every month on a war and we'll bring in the military guys when we need them and we'll bring in the civilian guys when we need them. This does not work. Episodic dialogue does not work. It's got to be continuous. And the President and Secretary of Defense are the only ones who have the positional authority to make the dialogue work. So it's their responsibility, in my view, to set the right conditions for the dialogue, but it's the responsibility of all participants to make the dialogue work. They are co-responsible for the fidelity of the process and the integrity of the information. They are co-responsible to increase the probability of final decision authority. Which is the second principle of final decision authority. This is the president, but the final decision authority applies not just to jus ad bellum issues, whether they're going to go to war or not, but also to jus in bello and jus post bellum issues. You're the final decision authority for all three of them. And having that authority comes with the job of being the president and secretary of defense. these actions, war aims, strategy, policies, campaigns, and all the other stuff are not just purely political actions, nor are they purely military actions. The issue in the principle that I describe in the book is not who has final decision authority. That's clear. The issue is, how is that decision responsibly used? How do you define responsible use of final decision authority? And here, again, I think, like everything in a democracy, final decision authority is limited in war. The limits are first constitutionally, because the Constitution splits the executive branch and the legislative branch in responsibilities for war. But there's also some moral limits. And you see these moral limits when you ask the question, how would irresponsible use of final decision authority work? What would be the result of irresponsible? Well, the result would be a lower probability that your war aims are achieved, increased probability that the lives you're going to use in the process are wasted, that the war will go on unnecessarily, longer than it needs to. And when irresponsible use is evident, that use is morally blameworthy, even if it's not illegal. And the just war theory ought to provide a way to talk about moral blameworthy activity, even if it's not legally guilty. So these factors help, I think, describe what responsible use is. The third principle that I lay out is a principle of managerial competence. And I thank you for not laughing at this principle, but I think it's an important one. Look, when you translate decisions or action, you act through an organization. And a department head that can't make his or her organization work is a less capacity than one who can. Bureaucracies have to translate decisions into actions. And that means that they either have to use the bureaucracy, bypass the bureaucracy, or change it. And this is hard, because no bureaucracy is good at doing something new or something fast, and something fast repetitively fast. But that's what war is. So the heads of departments, Department of Defense primarily, but all the other departments as well, have to make their departments work well enough to make sure that decisions get translated into action inside their department and among the departments. Because it's the synergy of all the departments that in execution of strategies, policies, and campaigns that will either increase or decrease the probability of achieving your war aims. And I think I think senior political leaders or military leaders who can hold soldiers responsible for actions in combat, for conducting operations in dangerous situations, for risking their lives every day, and look at themselves and say they're not holding themselves accountable for how well their bureaucracies work. At best, this is duplicitous behavior, and I think at worst, or more likely, is morally bankrupt behavior. So the third principle of managerial competence is simply to say, look, political leaders have to be more than politically reliable, and military leaders have to be more than just good war fighters. They need to be able to run the bureaucracies for which they have responsibility. The fourth principle, and if you're a J like me out there, when I get to four, that means you know there's five, that means there's only one more after this. The fourth principle is the principle of legitimacy. And this principle recognizes that even justified wars can lose their legitimacy from the eyes of citizens. Legitimacy in this sense, popular support of the citizenry is a function of going to war for the right reasons, following the laws of war, making progress toward war, and sustaining political support and integrating civil and military leadership properly together. So in effect, legitimacy in this sense is directly tied to senior civil and military leaders' ability to wage war, to go through those three responsibilities. And it recognizes that the U.S. public makes reasoned judgments about of the wars that are being fought on its behalf. When the population, when our citizens believe that a war is being fought, it's the right war, it's being fought well, there's a chance to succeed, and we should succeed, then they view the casualties as worth it. On the other hand, though, if it's incompetently run or governed by sustained imprudence, they make a similar conclusion. There's no way that this war can be won, and continuing a war in these conditions are not worth the casualties and the risk of lives. And so the three war waging responsibilities are tied directly to how the population views the legitimacy of a war. You can lose a war and through bad fighting, but you can also lose a war through poor waging as well. Last principle, and this one, the one that so far since I've published the book gets the most controversial reaction, is the principle of resignation. This principle recognized, and I believe that senior political and military leaders, their resignation is sometimes necessary under certain, and permissible under certain conditions. On one hand, I think resignation is necessary. It acknowledges that everyone, whether you're a private or a captain or a general, everyone remains a moral agent, responsible for his or her actions and his or her conscience. No soldier, no leader, no general is a mere instrument. We know this and we expect this of our soldiers. We have to expect it of our senior leaders as well. So resignation, not just necessary, it's also useful. It's a useful recuperative mechanism that helps the nation figure out when there are significant problems. It helps the nation understand that either what it's doing or how it's doing it is not working. And finally, resignation is useful because recognizing the possibility of resignation forecloses the option of just steamrolling senior civil and military leaders. Now, there's a downside, though, and especially as it applies to military leaders, and that is resignation can be or perceived to be a direct affront or direct challenge to civil control of the military. The principle that I describe in here tries to find that space between those two extremes. It's necessary, but it's got a downside. And so I try to describe how we can hold on to the positive aspects of resignation and avoid the negative ones. And I think actually Secretary Mattis's resignation is a really good example of what I talk about in the book. So that's the framework that I present in the book. It's not a framework for war waging that said this is the action you ought to take, but neither is the framework at the tactical level like that. All the frameworks do is try to increase the probability that there'll be just action on the battlefield and just action in the Capitol. The framework is also useful in judging, in explaining actions, and provides you a way to question leaders, which is always a good thing in a democracy. And therein, I think, lies the contribution that I tried to make, not to just war theory, but to the United States at large. So that's enough being said. I can barely stand my own voice for this long. Thank you very much, and please, let's hear some questions.
You grabbed me with the resignation line because I got to have lunch with General Tommy Franks, and I asked him what the press never asked him, which was, why did you resign? And he said, I didn't sign up for occupation. Of course, Dick Cheney discovered he was fired from the Bush White House when he heard Condoleezza Rice say that we were going to transform Iraq into a democracy the same way we did West Germany, Hong Kong, as an example for the region. And Cheney said, you don't understand the region. It's not going to change that way. the State Department is about to lose another war. Do you think that was the moment that we lost the Middle East wars?
No, actually, I think it happened way before then. But first, I don't think we've lost yet. We shouldn't have taken 18 years to figure this out. But the wars are still going on. So while I give due credit to my buddy Dan Bolger, whose book is Why We Lost, I think he was premature in deciding. Why? The better question for me is, why is it taking so darn long? Why have we screwed it up in the same way repetitively, making the same mistakes that we made in Afghanistan and making them again in Iraq, and then making in Iraq the same mistakes twice, and now considering making the same mistake back in Afghanistan again? This is the conundrum to me. I don't understand this. I think that we went astray almost immediately following 9/11, the 9/11 attacks. If you look at the time between the 9/11 attacks and the first bomb dropped or boots on the ground in Afghanistan, it was 26 days. Now tell me what governmental decision in the history of our country has made well in 26 days. It took 6 months from the time of post Pearl Harbor to the decision to invade North Africa, just to get things back. Now, of course, the military was a way different position in 1941 than it was in 2001. But we didn't take the deliberate time to think through we didn't create coherence at the beginning, and we still are relatively incoherent in 18 years later. So, no, I wouldn't say that was the time. I would say that 26 days between 9/11 and the first bomb drop, that was a time when we started to decrease the probability of our success.
Very interesting talk. I do want to ask you about a combatant's loss of his rights and how extensive is that, and et cetera. But I think your last principle was the principle of resignation. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
And I've just wondered, how realistic is that? How many high officials actually do resign if they disagree with a policy?
Sure.
You mentioned General Mattis, but this is almost a post career for him at the White House. Say an officer who has a long career and a lot, his whole life invested in his career, how realistic is it to expect him to resign over?
Well, it's hard. It's hard because, I mean, you, person like me, 37 years, I put a lot into this career. My family put a lot into the career. I did a lot of sacrifices. So for me to be able to say at some point in my career, I'm resigning from my position. Now, I didn't say I'm going to resign from being a commissioned officer. I said resign from my position. Now, there's a big difference in the two, and I can get into that if you want to. It's a big deal, but I can, and it's not done very often. I'll give you four examples. Mattis was one of them. First one comes from General Grant. Grant is the commanding general of the Army after the Civil War. Lincoln is killed. President Johnson is now the president. Johnson comes to Grant and said, I want you to go down and arrest Lee and Longstreet. And he gives him a list of other notable guys. And Grant says, no, I'm not going to do that. And I'll resign if you order me to do that. Johnson backed down. And Grant was right, I think, in making that threat. That would have resurrected the Civil War. And it was hard enough to do Reconstruction the first time. It would have been even more difficult if we had done. So that's one. He didn't resign. He threatened to resign. Similarly, George Marshall, World War II, when he was the Secretary of Defense, I think in his first confirmation hearing, he was asked what would he have done if the strategy that the president approved, Marshall believed was wrong in some fundamental way. And Marshall said, I would have had to resign because the president deserves a person who is consistent with his strategic outlook. Again, he didn't design, but he had in the back of his head what would be required. And both Grant and he knew that resignation sometimes is an important item, not just for themselves, but for the nation. And then the third one is Harold K. Johnson. I read about him in the book. Harold K. was the chief of staff during the Vietnam War, one of the chief staffs of the Vietnam War, who was going to resign. He and the chiefs, I don't know if you read a good book called Four Stars, Mark Perry, a couple of chapters about all of the service chiefs who were going to resign en masse. And then they decided, no, that would not be a good thing because that would be clearly a challenge to the civilian control of the military. So Harold K., though, decided he needed to resign because he knew that the war could not be won the way it was fought, and that every time he signed deployment orders, every time he sent someone to Vietnam, they were at risk to die in vain. And so he goes to there's a good account in Lewis Sorley's book about this called Honorable Warrior. So Harold K. drives over to the White House. This is before 9/11, so he could drive right up to the White House, and is ready to turn in his four stars, and he gets out of the car, comes back in the car, tells the driver to return to the Pentagon, and says to himself, they'll only get somebody else. Later on, after he retires, he writes a letter, I think to Harry Summers, actually, and says, I'm going to my grave knowing that I didn't have the moral courage to resign when I should have. And so these are four examples. There are not many in the history of 200, you know, X-teen years of our republic. But these are examples that I think show the legitimacy of the principle of resignation and also show the difficulty and the rareness of when resignation is required. Because truth be told, Marshall didn't have to resign because the arguments were so good. The dialogue was so robust that the resignation was never had to be on the table. Harold K., the dialogue was near zero under the Johnson administration. That, you know, so you can create the condition to increase or decrease the likelihood of resignation like you can anything else. Let me answer your question on rights. I wrote a separate paper on this when I was a captain. I'm a soldier, I lose my rights to life vis-a-vis the enemy. I got that. I don't lose it vis-a-vis to my chain of command, and I don't lose it vis-a-vis my government. The chain of command and the government have responsibilities to me as a citizen, still a citizen in uniform. A citizen, that's why I use the term citizens, now soldiers, in the book. So, okay, I got it. I may lose my rights. I can be killed legitimately in war, fighting on behalf of my country. And that's a pretty factual way to lose your right to life. No one's going to be tried for it. It's not any crime. But I don't lose my right. You, Lieutenant, me, Captain General, and you, President, Secretary, and you have responsibility to me as a citizen, and those I never lose. So that's how I square that circle.
In your book, do you use the lens you just described to us to assess various wars?
Yeah. No, I use Afghanistan, I use Iraq, but I also use the Civil War, World War II, Vietnam. So I think that the principles I'm trying to describe arise from the practice that the United States has executed from the beginning of the Republic.
And does any war come out unscathed?
Well,
from a just war perspective?
Here's why I'm hesitating. I am convinced that war is a realm of human activity in which the same act can be morally justified and morally reprehensible. That even if you do things according to every rule possible, you do the best you possibly can to follow the rule tactical, the warfighting principles. What you do sometimes is morally reprehensible. And so in that sense, you don't ever come out unscathed. But from the sense that at least I know I did what I followed the laws, I followed the right path, I'm unscathed and that I'm not morally culpable, but I'm scathed because it was reprehensible. So from that sense, on the tactical side, on the strategic side, I think very similarly that even under the best and most robust dialogue, you're never going to be perfect in your decisions. You're never going to be exact in the actions you take in execution, even if it's a perfect decision. And so again, war being conducted by human beings, and all human beings being fallible, in that sense, you don't ever come out unscathed. But that's why it's so important to do the best you can. See, I'm an Aristotelian at heart. See, good means you do the best you can, not good in some Platonic sense and there's an ideal. And so even if you do the best you can, it's all you can ask. And you might come out scathed in either tactically or strategically, but you'll be satisfied with yourself and your performance that you did everything you could to be as right as you could. So great question.
Do you have a concern about the use of like AI or computer decision robots where, you know, you don't have the soldier there, but these devices now make the decision to kill, but it'll allow policymakers to launch wars more, you know, without worrying about your own citizens'
death? Yeah, sure. But no, this should concern all of us. Let me say on one hand, this is coming, like it or not. The use of AI in decision-making, the use of AI to create, to move from semi-autonomous systems to autonomous systems, but this is coming. And so the moral requirement is for us to develop the systems in such a way that they have at least as good a chance of being morally right as a soldier does. And that's back to your question. None of us that are soldiers are 100% right in every decision we make, so we shouldn't expect our machines to be any better than that. But I think that that's one kind of way to answer the question. Another way to answer the question is there's just something asymmetrical about being killed by another human being and being killed by a fully autonomous system. And I think that this aspect, and there's a lot of, I'm not one of them, but there's a lot of just war theorists who are thinking about this. I have my own little niche that I have trouble keeping up with. It's going to do something to the nature of war, not just to the kind of war we fight, but the nature of war, when you take it out of the hands of human beings. It's still going to be a political instrument, because hopefully we're going to have an AI deciding to go to war, but in the execution, there'll be more and more decisions and actions taken not by human beings. And this is troubling to me, and something that should be troubling to us as a democracy. It should be troubling to us, not just will we do it, but troubling that others will. And it may well put us at a disadvantage if we don't figure out how to do it consistent with our national values. That's, to me, the real kicker. So thanks, good question. But you won't find any of that in this book. So thank you.
Thank you to Jim Dubik for a great discussion, and thank you to the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history, or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.